I am Gautam Kumra, Chairman of McKinsey Asia, and you're listening to the Future of Asia podcast series. The Asian century has begun. The region is now the world's largest economy. As Asia's economies evolve further, the region has the potential to fuel and shape the next normal. In each episode, we are going to feature conversations with leaders from across the region to discuss what Asia's rise means for businesses across the globe. Join us.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of the McKinsey Future of Asia podcast. My name is Debbie, and I am your host for today. In this episode, we will be speaking on the topic of new business building and why it is fast becoming a CEO's choice for growth in the 21st century. Now, I would like to introduce everyone to my two guests today, Marcus and Nirmal. Marcus, Nirmal, before we delve into the conversation proper, could the both of you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're currently doing at the firm? Marcus, why don't we start with you and then Nirmal can follow suit.
Very happy to be here. So my background, I've been in the firm now for 9 years and do what we call LEAP or business building. So I help clients that's both incumbents as well as build and scale new businesses. Prior to my time at McKinsey, there's almost 20 years of building startups. So I've been a CEO of a number of predominantly B2C businesses. So I've really been an entrepreneur all my life and continued that journey at McKinsey.
I'm based in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. I lead a LEAP for new business building for Asia for the firm. I do most of my work in Southeast Asia across the different markets, but increasingly we're finding real opportunities I'm finding myself spending time in Japan and India as well. And the nature of the business building we're doing, at least what I'm doing, is more B2C in nature, more consumer in nature. But we are seeing as a firm a nice spread across both B2B and B2C.
So thank you both for being here today. Now let us paint a general picture for our audience at home. Now, first and foremost, let's just ask the most fundamental question, which is, what exactly is new business building? Marcus, maybe you wanted to take that on?
So the idea is that in our any point in time, faster changing world, there's a need to, based on the new technologies and the disruptions that are there, there are changes in customer needs. And the question for a business is, how do I address them? And rather than just incremental changes, there's of course also the need and the possibility to actually build new businesses around that, which typically take one of these technologies and use it to either create a new business model but serve the same customer group, or you take your existing business model and you serve new customer groups, or you combine the two. And that's what we define as new business building. And the idea here is really to help companies build the capabilities that allow them to both come up with the ideas for these new businesses, but then to actually build them and scale them, which is an inherently different capability to running the normal course of business, which is much more focused on efficiency versus the innovation that you have to build and scale in the case of new business building.
Marcus, as one of the authors of the latest McKinsey Global Survey on new business building, what are some of the major new business building trends that came up in this survey? And was there anything that surprised you?
We've been doing the survey for a number of years now. And what I've been most surprised about is that over the years, the importance of business building has gone up, almost independent of where we currently are in terms of overall macroeconomic climate. So the number of CEOs that say that this is a top priority for them has now gone up to 58%, which is an increase over what we had in the previous years. So that's been a great surprise. I think the other piece that we're seeing is that over time, one of the key questions we always ask is, how much revenue are you seeing from new products and businesses that you've built over the last 5 years, and how much are you predicting for the next 5 years? And we're seeing that number is also slowly increasing. So you can say that the CEOs and leaders that have high expectations to business building are also starting to deliver. Now, the delivery numbers are still not in line with the priority numbers, but slowly the gap is closing. And I find that very encouraging because it basically means that all these companies that are responding to the survey are very much investing in their growth and are very much investing in innovation.
So then, what does the new business building landscape look like in Asia, Nirmal? Can you say that these global trends that Marcus talked about are applicable to the region as well? Or do you see that there's a little bit of nuance to this?
So at an aggregate level, I think the trends hold. What we're seeing is an equal level of excitement, an equal level of intent to kind of get into new businesses. I think the global imperative around having to branch into new business models, new businesses to preserve growth, that applies equally to Asia. In many industries, that didn't used to be the case because there was so much growth left in the core business. In most sectors, that's now plateauing. So many of our clients have the same imperative as the more developed markets to seek out new opportunities, to seek out new businesses to build. So I definitely see a consistency in that. Now, the nature of the new businesses could vary given the local market context, but the need to do it is there.
Now that we've given our listeners a little bit of context, let's talk a little bit about the application of new business building in the real world. And perhaps here we can also highlight a few examples to illustrate this. So firstly, and this is something I will pose to you, Marcus, what does successful new business building look like to you?
So what we're seeing is that business building is becoming more and more not just an art, but really a science. So where there's clear best practices, there's clear methodologies, and if you follow them, you can drive great success there. Business building is also, like most business activity, a portfolio game. So you really get better if you do it multiple times and if you actually capture the benefits from spreading your risk and the opportunities in the market. Yeah, so there's clear evidence that the companies that do it more often and that build up a portfolio also drive greater success. And the third interesting point when it comes to success is that the ones that are successful at this don't do it alone. So they invite partners to do it together with them. They bring investors, oftentimes venture capitalists, on board to actually invest alongside into the businesses, but also bring a lot of the experience and the rigor from the startup world into building new businesses. But there's also a clear notion of building ecosystems and being very deliberate and thoughtful about what do I do myself or my company versus where do I invite others to build an ecosystem and build a successful business together with me so that you can actually address the overall opportunity in the fastest, but frankly, also in the leanest way.
Nirmal, do you have anything to add on to Marcus's point?
A couple of things. Implicit within what Marcus said is, and let me just call it out because I think it's quite important. It's this tension between the culture you need to have in the new businesses you're building, and that culture is a function of the people slash talent you need and the way they work. And oftentimes that's quite different from the mothership, number one. But number two, the reason for building this business in the first place and what gives the entity the right to win. And that's typically some form of unfair advantage that that entity has, be it access to customers, data, markets, what have you. And bringing those together is not straightforward. And that's why there's historically been more failures than successes, because to create that culture, typically it's very hard to do it within the entity, because then the mothership drowns it out. So you want to do it outside. But then if it's done outside, then it's harder to access some of the assets, both tangible and intangible, that the mothership has. And so that bridge is the essence of what differentiates, in our view, successful versus unsuccessful new businesses. And that science that Marcus referred to, there's increasingly a playbook around how to manage that. And that's the essence of it. That's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is this point around partners. That's increasingly important for two reasons. Number one is one change we've noticed, or at least I've noticed over the past 5 years, is the expectation in terms of the time to get to scale is very short. And markets don't have patience, management teams don't have patience, boards don't have patience. So gone are the days where you can do this organically by yourself. Now, by the way, competitors aren't waiting around as well. They're quite nipping at your heels. So there's an imperative in most of the businesses we build to move fast. And the fastest way to move fast is by doing it with others and piggybacking on starting points that others have.
So then what examples have you seen that sort of bring this to life, whether it's within the region or globally?
So let me talk a bit about the category of businesses that I'm seeing. I think there's a number of industries where I am, together with clients, building businesses that you could put in a category of software as a service analytics businesses. What's the basic idea there? With modern technology, particularly sensors, Internet of Things devices, you can track a lot more in business processes. And what we see in many industries, that particularly medium and smaller size players in those industries are very much struggling to actually use that data to make much better decisions in their businesses. And that can be really across the entire value creation that a company does. So the business opportunity here is that you help those companies, that you basically build a software solution that takes that data and generates best practices, unique insights and recommendations for these players. You package it up and you sell it as a software as a subscription service to these smaller players. And what I'm seeing is that many of the larger players that have built up that expertise are packaging that expertise into software and are then providing that to the smaller and medium-sized players in their industries to make them more professional, which of course has significant implications on the margins of these companies, but also, for instance, very much helps on sustainability because it tends to also lead to savings in materials and energy, because if you get more efficient, if you have better insights on how to drive your business, that also drives up your efficiency.
So maybe I take more of an Asia-centric lens just to complement that. And what we see is maybe three broad themes, I'd say. And this is by no means comprehensive, right? But maybe a lot of what we're seeing falls in these three broad themes, and there are others. The first one is around organization with large consumer bases, finding adjacent means to kind of monetize this basis. So whether it's banks, looking at getting into digital banks, a different proposition to go after a different kind of segment, primarily retail banks, getting into wealth management, trading platforms and the like, whether it's telcos who are setting up alternative credit scores as a means of offering access to capital to segments who were previously unbanked. So there's a whole category there, which we find quite interesting. The second one around industrial players, very traditional organizations that are finding ways to basically reinvent themselves. And it's interesting, right? So you would not conceive of this, but oil and gas players getting into education platforms and oil and gas players getting into kind of with retail platforms, figuring out how to get into loyalty and the like. So it's a very interesting theme there. And the one I find the most interesting of all is this theme around green business building. That there's multiple flavors of this. The two areas within green business building that's taken, or wasn't the most traction here, is renewables and various forms of renewables, solar, wind, what have you, including, by the way, rooftop. So building out a rooftop distributed generation business. Number two is around electric mobility. And in an Asian context, two-wheeler electric mobility, we see taking off really, really fast. And this is not only about charging stations and the likes. This is around battery swap stations or battery swap points, where if I'm on a motorbike, a two-wheeler motorbike, I can go in, swap my battery and ride off within 1-2 minutes. And then beyond that, given I spend so much time in Southeast Asia, there's a lot of excitement around nature-based solutions and how that can be monetized by means of carbon credits and platforms coming up in and around that. So all that to say, the breadth is wide, but it's super exciting.
So you've talked about sustainability and green business building in particular, Nirmal. Why do you think that green business building, out of the many different types that you could diversify into, is gaining traction in this part of the world?
I think it comes down to the technology has gotten to the point where it's actually in the money in most cases. So renewables in most parts of Asia, solar is as competitive as gas, and at current coal prices, as competitive as coal. Once it's in the money, and given, you know, it's the right thing to do, there's just such tailwind around it. There's consumer demand for it. The supply side is just coming together very nicely. Electric mobility, I would argue, is not yet in the money for four-wheelers, but is in the money for two-wheelers. And so it's coming together again. And it's not requiring too much government facilitation. It's private sector getting on with it, which is what's so exciting. Carbon platforms or carbon trading platforms, honestly, this is more European-driven. And Europe being a market for then the supply side on this side. I didn't mention circularity, but circularity is a big trend. So use cooking oil, for example. It used to be a very mom and pop kind of thing. There'll be an old uncle in his truck coming around and collecting your used oils. And there'll be hundreds, if not thousands, of these across the countries. That's starting to get professionalized. There's platforms around that. I think it's just the time, both from a point of view of consumer maturity, sophistication, and demand for it. And the supply side getting to the point where it's finally proving tenable and sustainable economically to do so.
Let me also add another point on circularity. So I think the idea here isn't just driven by we need to get better at this to save the planet from the climate crisis. I think there's also very much a trend on overall geopolitics and companies thinking about their supply chains and how they can make them more secure, less dependent on particular geographies, being resilient to any sorts of interventions. So there's really those two things coming together that incentivizing, or you could also say forcing, companies to really rethink their value chains and think about what are the alternatives for how I could organize that. And that in combination with, of course, a lot of R&D coming from universities and great innovation from startups and other companies, all of that really creates that perfect melting pot that creates new business opportunities there.
So before we round off the discussion, I just wanted to pose to both of you a very simple question before we close off for today, which is, if a CEO was listening to this podcast and you only had one key takeaway for him, what would that be?
The one key takeaway I would take away is the following. Done right, new business building by established organizations don't need to have the same 10, 12% success rate of VCs. Done right, the expectation should be it's more in the range of 50 to 65% in terms of this. I mean, it's never going to be 100%, but I should be aspiring towards a 65% type success rate on my portfolio of new business builds that I do, which has a few implications. The first one is that it is a portfolio game. As Marcus talked about just now, it is a portfolio game. And putting all your eggs into one basket is dangerous, but at the same time, it's not a portfolio game at the extent of a VC who's doing tens or hundreds of these. It's a portfolio game, typically at a level of 4 or 5, because that's the capacity any organization has the bandwidth to kind of absorb. No more than that. Number two, there is a playbook in terms of how to shift your odds from 12% to 65%. And it's worthwhile immersing and ensuring that it's set up the right way before embarking on it. Because it makes a huge difference if you've got a 12% chance of success versus a 65% chance of success. And then the final point I would make is the essence of it is trading off this tension between the access to the unfair advantage that the organization has versus doing it sufficiently separate from the organization such that you can actually create this nimble culture that you need to have here.
Great points, Simon. Let me add a couple. One is, I think there's clearly a notion for the ones that do it really successful that I would frame as be outrageous in your ambitions, or you could also say dream big, and then really deliver on it. So that's one. And at the same time, I would almost say kill fast. So that is be very rigorous in your testing. Don't fool yourself with hypotheses, assumptions that you haven't proven. And when you learn that something doesn't work, then stop investing into the idea and redeploy the people, the capital to other areas. If there's one thing that you can, even with the large portfolio, learn from a VC is that they just stop much, much faster. And larger incumbent organizations have a tendency to just drag on because the decision to stop something always feels hard on some people. Where I would always frame that as you're actually doing everybody a favor because you're giving them the opportunity to work on something new, to do something exciting versus letting them drag on and oftentimes leaving them with the feeling where everybody feels like this isn't really working, but somebody is at least implicitly asking me to carry on. And that's just a big waste of resources and great talent. And that shouldn't happen.
This has been a really informative session. Thank you, Marcus and Nimal, for your time today. And thank you all for listening in to our latest episode of the Future of Asia podcast. I hope you've taken something away from us. And if you would like to know more about new business building or any of our new business building service lines, please go to www.mckinsey.com/futureofasia for more information. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Future of Asia podcast by McKinsey & Company. To learn more about McKinsey, our people, our latest thinking, visit us at mckinsey.com/futureofasia or find us on LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook.